This is MSO News Sports, talking now with basketball insider Mike Grenier. Mike, welcome back to MSO. How are you?
We're doing fine. We're a little bit past the halfway point of the NBA season, and the Celtics are still doing fine, although there have been some troubling moments, right, Rick, in the last couple weeks.
You know, I want to talk about that Clippers game because the Clippers, they rolled out from start to finish. But I just wonder if that points out a glaring need for Porzingis in order for this team to be a championship team.
Well, it does point out a glaring need for Porzingis, who has missed 13 of the team's 46 games. Now, is that alarming number? It's not, but it's a concerning number because, if you think down the road, and the Celtics, let's say, have the best record or close to the best record in the NBA, you want to have the home court. So I say to myself, put yourself in the month of May or June, and with Porzingis, could he put up with the toughness of a 6 or 7-game series against Philadelphia, Milwaukee, and then Denver, perhaps, or Oklahoma City? And at this point, I start to say I question it because he's been down with these injuries. They're definitely legitimate injuries, but they keep happening to him. You know, Rick, it's like we've seen players over the years. They seem to be injury-prone. Certain players are injury-prone. And it's not because they're jaking it. They're not taking time off because they want to, like Kyrie Irving does. But they're legitimately injured. But the same guy seems to be getting injured over and over and over again. And am I glad the Celtics have Porzingis? No question. Here's a guy who's averaging 19.5 on a team that has Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, putting up big numbers. So it's great to have a third scorer who can throw 20 points a game at you or more. And he also rebounds well. He's a good free-throw shooter. He blocks a lot of shots. But the fact that he's missed 13 games at this point, it's not alarming, but I think it's concerning.
Yeah, I think there's, instead of red alert, it's a yellow alert right now. I agree, and that was one of the problems when we thought about Porzingis coming to the team, if he could hold up. So far, when he's in there, they look unbeatable. When he's not in there, they look good.
And referring back to the Clippers game you mentioned where the Clippers led from start to finish, the Celtics were never in it. Yes, they missed Porzingis, but that particular night, Derek White shot 0-for-8. And he's having a great year. 0-for-8, and he had like 2 points. And Al Horford was like 0-for-5. So you had two starters going 0-for-13. That's highly unusual for those two guys, but that going along with Porzingis being injured caused it to be a blowout. And the other part of that fact is that the other 50% of the results of that game is because the Clippers are playing the best basketball of any team in the past month or so.
Well, yeah, they are, and everybody has a good streak and a bad streak. But the other thing you point out that I want to point out is there was a minute there when we thought Al Horford was going to go down with a bad finger, and then where does that leave you?
Right, exactly. Where would that leave you? They go deeper into the bench, and Luke Cornett has actually been playing very well for a guy who has limited skills, but he knows what he's doing, what he can do and can't do, and he's been a great fill-in, I think. But you can't lose Horford, but I think Horford's going to be fine. I think now you look at tonight, the Celtics are playing Zion Williamson and the Pelicans, and they have to come right back tomorrow night and play the Indiana Pacers back-to-back games. At least they're at home. But that means Horford's going to sit out one of these two games. So, again, they have to dig deeper into the bench and see what's happening. That's why the Celtics have to hope that Porzingis can show up and be effective either for one or both games.
Up to this point, they've been able to lose 2-3 starters and do fine. So they're a very, very solid team. But it leads me to ask the question, are they going to add someone else? I know a couple of names have been batted around. Gordon Hayward's one of them. In terms of, before the trade deadline.
Yep.
What do you think, Mike?
Well, I think Gordon Hayward's a nice name. But, again, when I look at the box scores, he's missing the games, like, not 50% of the time, but he's missed an awful lot of games this season already.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he has an injury history. So I don't know that I would want to take that chance. If you're getting him for nothing, in other words, if the Celtics don't have to give up much for him, might be worth a shot because he's a veteran, he's a scorer, he knows he knows the Celtics players. He'll fit into the system. He's very coachable. He can score a lot of points still. But I don't know if I want to take a chance on him because he's been injury prone. So, it's tough to get a really – you can't get a great player at the trade deadline. You can get a good player or a decent player that's going to fill your needs coming off the bench, and I think that's what the Celtics need, a guy who can fill some needs off the bench or be an emergency starter. Let's say Horry Haywood could certainly be an emergency starter and be very good at it. But you have to wonder about his health because he's had a long history of problems.
Well, you've got to get someone in, too, like a Malcolm Brogdon, who will fit in
right.
and know his role, because I think, as we've seen from Brad Stevens, from Joe Mazzulla, from all the writers in the Globe and the Herald, the team has great chemistry and they really work well together, so you don't want to screw that up. So it makes it even more difficult to find a veteran player who can fit into that scheme.
Right. Well, Haywood would fit into that scheme in terms of his approach to the game because he's always been a good soldier, a great teammate for any team he's been on. And, you know, fortunately, the Celtics still have Jason Tatum is having the best year of his career. And obviously, I don't care about the All-Star game, but the fact that he's going to be a starter is a great tribute to him. But to me, he's having his best year, not just in terms of putting up numbers and capable of scoring 35 and 40, but in terms of his leadership. I think we've talked about this before. I just think he's just working extra hard to keep the team in first place, to keep the team running, in the running for the best record in the NBA. I just think he's doing a fabulous job. He's rebounding better. He gets to the foul line. And, of course, Jaylen Brown, too. He has his ups and downs. He has problems making clutch free throws. He's only shooting 72% from the free throw line, Rick, which is not a good number for a guy with his skill. And he comes up with too many turnovers. But, boy, he could certainly put up tremendous individual scoring games. We saw that against Dallas last week when he just – Luka Doncic, who had a 70-point game recently, he was helpless trying to guard Jaylen Brown. Absolutely helpless.
And did you see the play? Did you see the play where Doncic went down?
Oh, yeah. I think it was like two plays in that half. Doncic went down. We call those – breaking his ankle.
And Doncic, to his credit, I guess at the home video showed it up, and of course the players went nuts at home. Why are you showing that? And Doncic, to his credit, says, I don't mind because Jaylen earned that one. He just wiped me out.
Right. And I thought the funniest thing about that whole stretch of basketball was that after halftime, Doncic showed up wearing a different pair of sneakers. That was going to help. And, you know... Yeah. You know, he just didn't want to be seen on TV with the same pair of sneakers. That's the guy that Jaylen Brown is abusing, you know? So Jaylen Brown is certainly capable of that, and I think he and Tatum together still make a great duo as top scorers. They understand each other's games. As a matter of fact, during that Dallas game, one thing I noticed, Rick, was that in the fourth quarter, Jaylen Brown was going so well that Jason Tatum was actually sort of ceding the authority to him.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that, Mike, because you've
yeah.
been in locker rooms to some of the greatest teams that have ever been assembled,
right.
And so many alpha males, so many alpha
right.
dogs, and yet some of them, it seems to me, because you mentioned Jaylen Tatum's leadership, and I totally agree, Jason Tatum, but Jaylen Brown, he's an alpha dog, he knows how good he is,
yes.
And but I do see him, and I love the way you just described JT's reaction, because Jaylen Brown will cede the leadership to Jason Tatum, even though I'm sure
right.
that he feels he could be the man. And then now you're saying Jason Tatum did the same thing with Brown, supporting Brown. So
right.
There's
right.
a
and
real...
And I recall in that fourth quarter when Jaylen Brown slowed down just a little bit, Jason Tatum went on a run to close out the game.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think Jason Tatum has a really good feel for the game these days.
Oh.
I just think he has a tremendous, a tremendous vision about where this team can go and his role in it. And he knows he's the leader, and he knows he can score 30, 35, 40, 45, but yet he knows what his teammates can do as well. That's why if Porzingis has a hot hand, he's going to get the ball to Porzingis. If Derek White has a hot hand, Derek White's going to get his number of shots. So you got to keep everyone happy because it's an ego-driven game, much more so than even when Bird was playing. But the thing I remember about Bird is that even though he could score 30 any time, if Kevin McHale had a hot hand, I mean, Bird was such an exceptional passer. he found McHale on virtually, let's say, two out of every three possessions. Or the same thing with Robert Parrish.
Oh, Parrish, yeah.
He just had an innate sense of how the game was going, and he would say, all right, I'm going to sacrifice my scoring and let these other guys score because we're going to win that way.
Well, I like the way somebody said one time recently, instead of saying sacrifice, it's contributing to the team. And
yeah.
Without question, because obviously sacrifice means ego. You're giving up your stats. But contributing to the team means, you know, the old Auerbach thing. We're not interested in stats. We're interested in the W's.
Right, exactly.
And I think
Jason Tatum has taken that step this year.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I agree.
I think in his own mind, he feels that this is the Celtics, the best Celtics team he's been on, and it has the best shot at winning it all. So he's going to do everything he can to make that happen.
Okay, the other thing, we mentioned that, you know, Porzingis missing the Clippers game. However, Mike, let me ask you, because some of these games in the NBA have been mind-boggling with the scores this year.
Yeah.
And if it weren't for the fact that Porzingis has missed so many games, would we even be worried about Clippers beating the Celtics in a game during the regular season?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. Because the Celtics have shown, even on the road, they blow out some really good teams. And so that tells me that down the road in the playoffs, there won't be, I don't know if there'll be that many blowouts, but there'll be a lot of close games, and the Celtics are certainly capable of winning on the road.
Mm-hmm.
They've shown that throughout the regular season here, sometimes even in back-to-back situations. I mean, that Dallas game was a perfect example. Dallas had been resting for 4 days.
Right.
Another game, you know, hanging around, having practices and all that, just waiting, laying in wait for the sort of hoping for an ambush of the Celtics. And the Celtics came in there and cleaned house. So it tells you what the Celtics are capable of when they're on top of their game. And they, let's face it, you know, even though they've stumbled lately a couple of games, the Bucks destroyed them too. They still have the best record in the NBA. They're still like three games up on the Bucks. They're having a great year themselves, obviously. They fired their coach. Doc Rivers comes in. That's going to be another interesting tidbit to the entire mix, Rick, as we move forward through the months of April and May and all that, is, you know, the Bucks firing the coach because they felt he's not the guy that could take them all the way this year. And they felt, okay, they're going to cut their losses. They fire Adrian Griffin, and, you know, Doc Rivers agrees to take over the team, right? So,
well, you can't get a better replacement than Doc Rivers. I mean, we all know that.
Right.
However, what does that mean about the brass firing a coach who's got his team in second place with a great record?
Well, I think the brass felt that they made the wrong choice, and they could see it happening, you know, about halfway through the season, and they felt rather than go with Adrian Griffin, they didn't like the way he handled things with his defense. And they said, we're not going to beat the Celtics playing this way. We may not even beat Philadelphia or the New York Knicks playing this way in the playoff. So therefore, let's draw, even though it seems cruel, the guy had a 30-13 record.
Right.
And that seems, I can't recall a coach being fired.
No.
Such a good record.
No.
Okay, in all the years that we've seen NBA. And but they bring in an experienced coach who's won a championship with the Celtics, who's had a great record overall. And, you know, they're hoping that Doc Rivers adds just that right mix of discipline and culture and defensive savvy that the Bucks management is looking for. It's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out as the season progresses.
Well, I'm happy for Doc Rivers, but I'm a little nervous now that he's in the same conference, you know, the same division as the Celtics, because we have great respect, at least I do, for Doc Rivers. I think he's tremendous. All right, Mike, I know that I'm taxing your voice here coming off pneumonia, so a couple of more quick things.
Okay.
I want to ask you about the plethora of 70-point scorers going on this year.
Yes. I mean, we have had, oh my goodness, not only have we had Doncic with 73, I think it was like a third or fourth highest scoring game in history, but the same night that he did it, Karl Anthony Towns of the Minnesota Timberwolves had 62, and Devin Booker of the Phoenix Suns, a great shooting guard who once scored 70 against the Celtics early in his career, he had a 62-point game, and he's averaging 50 points a game in the last three games. So we've had a rash of high-scoring games, and I say to myself, is it because of the lack of defense by opposing teams, or is it because these guys are so skilled offensively that, you know, you can't prevent them from scoring? Of course, we had Embiid score 70 as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Embiid, a franchise record. You know, you're familiar with the Philadelphia teams and all that, and you know, all the great players they've had, Julius Erving and everybody else, and yet Embiid's the guy that set the franchise record with 70. So, you know, I think there's a lot of factors involved. All these back-to-back games the teams play. If you're playing the second game of back-to-back, the opposing team, you know, may not be fatigued, and a guy goes off and gets 50 or 60 or 70. But I haven't seen this kind of scoring in many years.
No.
And I also think that the officiating has something to do with it, Rick, from the standpoint of offensive players, fouls that would have been offensive fouls 20, 25 years ago, they're being let go. And that's why Giannis Antetokounmpo of the Milwaukee Bucks gets to the foul line 20 times one game. The night that Embiid had 70, he was 21 for 23, I believe, at the foul line.
Wow. Yeah.
So they have more leeway, the offensive players do. They seem to be able to lean into the defensive players, push off if they have to. We see Tatum and Brown do it, and they get away with it because that's the way the league is being officiated these days. So they're just following everybody else. But you also see some very skilled offensive players. I mean, Devin Booker has been a great shooter since the year he came into the league. So he scored 70 against the Celtics several years ago, and now he's scoring 50, 60, 65. And that won't happen in the playoffs because defenses tighten up, and coaches obviously have a scheme for a six-game or seven-game series, and they came up with defensive schemes that will prevent players from getting 60 or 70. But certainly during the regular season, you're seeing these random games where skilled players are getting 50, 60, and 70.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's a very fan-friendly game. Obviously, when you're seeing that, when you're paying big money to a game and you see Embiid score 70, you go away pretty happy if you're a Philadelphia fan. So,
you betcha. All right, Mike, I'm under a little time constraint here, so I want to finish up. We'll save your Power 5 for later.
Sure.
I just want to ask you about the article you wrote about a UMass player who's a local kid.
Matt Cross, Beverly, Massachusetts. He's a senior now, and I remember seeing him at the University of Miami 4 or 5 years ago. He was highly recruited. He didn't go to Beverly High School. He went to Brewster Academy up in New Hampshire, was a terrific player there. So he was highly recruited, went to Miami. He didn't quite fit in there. I remember he just really didn't feel comfortable there. So he transferred to Louisville, played there a couple of years, and then he transferred closer to home, UMass. And he's been a tremendous player at UMass the last 2 years. He's averaged 12.5 points a game last year. And this year, he's up around 17 points a game. He leads the team in he's the second leading scorer on the team. Leads the team in rebounds. He's 6'8". But he averages 17 points a game, 8.5 rebounds per game. And UMass is 13-7. And really, they have a big player. Josh Cohn is like 7 feet tall. They also have some skilled guards. They have a shot in the conference tournament of coming out of that conference tournament, perhaps winning it. I think that Dayton is probably the best team in that league, the Atlantic 10. So UMass, really, they have an outside shot of making the NCAA tournament. And it's Matt Cross. I know that the UMass fans love him. Because of he basically, Rick, reminds you, because of his work ethic, he's a Bird-type player, a McNeil-type player. By that I mean he's not fancy, but he gets the job done, and you look at the end of the night, and he has 18 points, 9 rebounds, 2 for 5 on 3-pointers, 6 assists. He fills up the stat line. He's an extremely solid. I know the coach, Frank Martin, absolutely loves the kid. I believe he called him one of the top 5 players in that conference. So, this kid's having a great year, and, you know, it'd be great to see him bow out
and,
by making the NCAA tournament.
And being a UMass grad, I'd like to get rid of that Calipari bad taste in my mouth. That would be awesome.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All right, Mike, I got to get going, but, geez, thanks so much. Hey, have a hot toddy, get some honey in that tea, and take care of yourself, and have a good evening.
You too, Rick. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Mike. Take care. Be well.
Yeah.
All right. That's Mike Grenier, who is our basketball insider. With MSO News Sports, I'm Rick Moore.